Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin legal expert joins the show with a look at the closing days of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha. First, there was a lot of talk about the phrase flattening the curve in the early days of the novel coronavirus. The idea was to try to reduce the spiking number of infections to give hospitals and vaccine developers a chance to catch up. In his new book, our next guest looks at another much bigger disease curve that has been flattening over a much longer period of time. The cycle of infectious diseases killing off huge parts of populations for millennia. He says we're in a much better place now, but we've got to be careful about where we go next. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How have you been reflecting on the coronavirus pandemic as it compares to other historic outbreaks of infectious diseases? Do you have thoughts on what we could do to be better prepared as a state, a country, a world for whatever the next infectious disease might look like? Do you have a question about the history? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Charles Kenny is senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. He's authored the book The Upside of Down, Why the Rise of the Rest is Good for the West. His latest book is called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be back with you.
A lot of us have been thinking about global disease for the last year and a half. You started thinking about it a lot earlier because this book was a few years in the making before we even heard of COVID-19. What got you thinking about this broad scope, this broad sweep of our disease history?
I'm interested in global progress. I work in global development and used to work at the World Bank and now work in this think tank that thinks about how we can speed global progress. And if you look at sort of the most unarguable statement about the improving condition of humanity, I think it involves children. We have gone from a world where the average parent would expect to bury at least one of their children before the age of five, to that being a rarity worldwide. We've gone from sort of half of children dying young to about 1 in 25 worldwide over the last two centuries. And you look at that statistic, you look from us going from this tragic situation where you know it is expected to bury a child to that being an all too frequent but still far rarer tragedy today, and you ask why, and the answer is a decline in infectious disease. So I became very interested in why was it declining? You know, what was the story behind that? What was going on? And was there a risk of backtracking? The last sort of 18 months, 2 years sort of helps answer the second part of that question. I started in on the research before COVID-19 began, as you suggested.
Looking at the first part of that story, can you talk about, I mean, you share examples in your book of a lot of major historical plagues, the actual plague and other things we might call plagues. How, talk about just what a huge factor in individual lives and even the grand sweep of human society disease was until really just, a couple hundred years ago?
Absolutely. It sort of drove the entire nature of the world economy, if you will. So basically, civilization is a disaster for human health, to put it bluntly, because what agriculture and civilization did was it took a bunch of humans who were hunter-gatherers and it stuck them much closer together at much higher density with a lot of animals who fostered diseases that could jump species, you know, much like we think probably COVID-19 jumped species from bats. Other diseases jump species from our domesticated animals. So, you know, pigs and chickens that get flu and so on. Cows get something akin to measles. So packing a whole load of people very close together in constant contact with their animals led to a firestorm of disease and you know, hugely increased young mortality and infant mortality. That alone had a big effect. not least on women who just in order to keep sort of populations constant, the average woman had to have sort of 6 or 7 children. Half of them got pregnancy related illnesses. Many of them, you know, sadly died during pregnancy and childbirth. So, you know, hugely bad for humans in general. They saw worse health outcomes, in particular bad for women. And infection was such a burden that it basically, you know, stopped empire spreading, stopped cities getting bigger, because the bigger cities got, the more they became death traps, you know, the more infection killed. And so there was sort of a limit to how large cities could get, and a limit to how large civilizations could get. Rome grew to be one of the largest empires in world history, but was felled not least by the first appearance of Yersinia pestis, the plague of the Black Death, you know, which sort of wiped out large parts of the population of the Roman Empire, and in particular large parts of the Roman army, and, you know, was one factor in the continuing decline of Rome. And 800, 900 years later, you see the cycle repeat with the Black Death wiping out a third to a half of the population of Europe. And it's only with our advances against infection, it's only with proper sanitation systems, public health laws and regulations, and in particular the sort of the medical revolution of vaccines and antibiotics and so on, that we've managed to push down this burden of disease in such a way that nowadays cities are healthier places to live than rural areas worldwide. On average, city dwellers live longer than rural populations. Nowadays, traveling to another country is not a death sentence like it used to be. It's what's allowed for global cities like, you know, New York or London, with their populations of 10, 15 million, a third of whom come from other countries. It's, you know, the only thing that allows those cities to survive and be the creative centers of the global economy today. And it's the only thing that's allowed for a revolution in women's rights as well. You know, if you don't have to have 7 or 8 children per woman in order just to keep populations constant, if you can get that down to, you know, 2, close to 2 as it is worldwide today, that frees up a lot of time that women were spending, you know, in pregnancy and childbirth, but also, you know, massively improves their health, massively improves their possibility to take, you know, equal part in society in general. So it has all sorts of effects on the global economy. It improves education outcomes, encourages people to get more educated. I could go on, but it really is a vital part of a story that takes us from a world where most people are living in extreme poverty, most children are dying in childhood, to a world where most people are living on incomes multiples of what they're used to, and most people are living, you know, past the age of 70.
Talking to Charles Kenny about his new book, The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. You could join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Charles, you worry in your book about some very particular risks we have of disease, but also more generally, I think, of a kind of complacency. A lot of us in the world now grow out without that daily risk of horrific infectious disease outbreaks, and maybe we're letting our guard down.
I think that really is a large risk. You know, even today, even after what we've gone through in the last 2 years, we see complacency around making sure the world as a whole works together to reduce the, you know, future risk of new pandemics, but also to sort of finish the job of wiping out infections that are still killing millions worldwide. Just to take some examples, if you look at tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV, last year their death toll was probably about the same as the official death toll from COVID-19. Now, COVID-19 actually killed more people than the official death toll, but HIV, malaria, and TB have been killing that many year in, year out, killing it more than that many year in, year out, you know, for decades. And we've sort of let them fester because they kill poor people in poor countries. And so we sort of, you know, largely, I'm afraid, as a global society, don't particularly care. We use antibiotics at the moment, these magical weapons against bacterial infection. 90% of antibiotics we have, we don't use to cure humans from infectious disease. We use them in order to make factory farmed animals grow a bit fatter, a bit faster. The risk of developing antibiotic resistant diseases amongst those animals that can then jump species to humans is huge. But, you know, because we like our cheap meat, we're willing to take that risk. So in all sorts of different ways, we're acting as if, you know, we don't care, we don't see the threat, and we're still doing it today. I mean, just to take an example, the Build Back Better bill that is still going through Congress, you know, partially as a pandemic response, it's been cut down from its original size. But one of the things that's been most cut in it, it's been cut by 2/3 of the pandemic response measures in it. You know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic that's killing thousands of Americans a week, and yet already we're sort of cutting back. We're reducing our ambition when it comes around to pandemic preparedness. So I agree. I think there is this sort of this problem of success we face, that in a world where, you know, half the population was dying from infectious disease, it was really hard to ignore. Now we're in a world where, thanks to medical progress and thanks to public health, that doesn't happen anymore. We do seem to be sort of reasonably blasé about the deaths that remain and the threat of many more deaths in the future.
We're talking to Charles Kenny about his new book, The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We're going to look at some of what our guest says are lessons for the future from COVID-19 and past diseases. Do you have thoughts? Do you want to see more effort put into public health here in the United States or into curing diseases around the world, even if they don't affect the U.S. Directly? Do you think there are things we could have done better with COVID-19 that maybe with the next pandemic, whatever it might look like, we could do better next time around? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Charles Kenny from the Center for Global Development. We're looking at his new book. It's called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease, looking at lessons from all of human history, plus the latest with COVID-19, lessons that can help us avoid going back to the bad old days when infectious disease was a very real threat to daily human life and even civilizations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a lesson you hope, say, American policymakers can learn from COVID-19 and the response there? Do you have a question for our guest about disease and history? And on a personal note, how about, I know our guest is curious, how about those COVID booster shots? Are you going to get one if you've already been vaccinated? Do you worry about the choice, you getting a booster or somebody getting their first shot in a poorer country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charles, I understand that is something that's on your mind. Some in the U.S. getting their third shots, a lot of countries around the world waiting for their first shots for people.
Yeah, I should admit, I got my third shot. I'm in a slightly higher risk group, thanks to a heart condition. And so I was, you know, in the list that CDC said, maybe you want to get a third shot. And I did. But as I got my third shot, as I sat there feeling incredibly grateful for medical progress and for these vaccines, you know, I couldn't help but think about the vast majority of people, even in high-risk groups in low-income countries worldwide, that haven't had their first shot yet. We are managing this vaccine rollout in a better way than we've ever done in history before, by which I mean it looks like the whole world will get to, you know, 50-60% vaccinated way faster than we manage with smallpox or with measles or with diphtheria or pertussis or tetanus. Sort of name your previous vaccine rollout effort. We're gonna get from 0 to 60-ish faster than ever before. In that way, it's a great global triumph. On the other hand, it is terrible how badly we've done compared to how well we could have done. Rich countries, including the United States, are sitting on so many vaccines that they're expiring before we can use them. Meanwhile, in poor countries, terribly, you know, high-risk communities, you know, the very old and so on, are sitting there without a vaccine, access to a vaccine at all. It's just sort of, it's morally wrong, it's repugnant. And so, you know, I did the selfish thing. I protected myself a bit more. I wish the system was better set up so, you know, next time we vaccinate more people more faster and much more equitably, you know, in particular, vaccinating those who need the vaccine most first.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Catherine is with us in Menominee Falls. Catherine, hi.
Hi. I guess you're speaking to a pretty biased person here, but I have sincere concerns for people who have had difficulty with COVID, but we lost four family members to cancer in the last 5 years, including my beloved husband. And I cannot believe that there's no cure for cancer when we've had we have never had a sitting president in this country with cancer.
Catherine, thank you so much. I'm so sorry for your loss and your family there. Cancer is a different kind of disease, Charles. It's not as, I guess, some kinds of cancer can relate to certain kinds of infection. I'm thinking HPV here, but it operates differently than the infectious diseases you're talking about.
It does. And I join you in being terribly sorry for the listeners' loss. Cancer is now you know, one of the greatest killers in the United States, one of the greatest killers worldwide. Because infectious disease deaths have gone down so much, sadly, people still die in the end, and more are dying from cancer and heart disease. I too have experienced some recent losses from both, and I don't mean to, you know, downplay the horror. And I think we do need to make more rapid progress against those diseases. And I think that too should be very much a public health priority. And as we make further advances against infection, you know, even more of a public health priority than it is today. As you say, some cancers can be prevented by vaccines, and HPV is one example where we've seen, you know, really dramatic recent evidence of the efficacy of vaccines in saving lives against some cancers. And I hope maybe one of the silver linings that comes out of the COVID-19 period and the research into these new types of vaccines like the mRNA vaccines is that we see more cancers that can be treated by vaccines. We see more vaccines developed against them. That'll only be, you know, one part of the story of the fight against cancer. But I hope it's a part of a story that's been given a boost by the last 2 years.
Catherine, thanks for that call. We're talking to Charles Kenny about his new book called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Charles, I want to get another prescription for the future that you're looking for. You mentioned reining in the use of antibiotics, especially among animals, as one cure, investing in public health or not stopping our investments in public health. You are also hoping to see more and more effective international communication on diseases. What would that look like?
At the moment, the World Health Organization, a sort of, you know, international body that's meant to look after global health, its core budget is about the same as one large US hospital. It's a really underfunded part of the global architecture. And I know it doesn't do everything perfectly right, far from it. And I think it really made some mistakes in its early calls on things like masking, suggesting that maybe masking wasn't a priority during the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, you can argue forever about what it said about where the virus came from, but it still plays a vital role in coordination. Even during COVID-19, it played a really important role in coordinating trials of various treatments against COVID-19. those trials can run faster if they take place where there's a lot of COVID-19 infection going on. And so being able to move trials around the world to sort of where the pandemic is at that stage is a really powerful way to increase the accuracy and speed of our trials of potential cures and vaccines and so on. So there's just a really big role for better international coordination on this in this area. And in particular, there's a big role for the immediate response. The best way to deal with a pandemic is immediately emerges before it spreads around the world. What we really want is every country having the capacity, the domestic capacity or domestic capacity supported by the international community to respond to pandemic outbreaks, you know, at source really rapidly, close it down there before it spreads across borders, before it goes worldwide. You know, if we'd managed that with COVID-19, you know, think of the lives saved, think of the trillions of dollars saved as well. So, you know, next time, I hope we get together as a global, before next time, I hope we get together as a global community and coordinate far more on thinking, how do we get instantaneous response to outbreak threats and really get the support to where they're happening in real time so that we can shut them down before they spread.
Just 30 seconds or so, Charles, you've immersed yourself in studying these scary diseases for 5+ years now. Did you come out of this feeling more optimistic or pessimistic about our disease future?
Optimistic. I have worries. You know, we could muck it up. We could allow new pandemics to spread. We could allow old infections to come back. But we've seen in the last 2 years, we've seen in the last 2 centuries, what we can achieve as humanity against these infections. And I think we're going to continue making that sort of progress. I certainly hope we do.
Charles, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rob.
That's Charles Kenny, senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. We talked to him about his latest book. It's called The Plague Cycle: The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Coming up after the news, the trial in the fatal shootings at Kenosha protests last year is drawing to a close. A Wisconsin legal expert joins the program for a look at what we've heard from witnesses, the judge, and attorneys on both sides of the case. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a MAPS project so extensive it's taken 40 years of research and work is approaching completion. It all happened here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to the director of the project about what he wants people to get from it and his deep love for MAPS. Now, closing arguments are wrapping up today in the case against Kyle Rittenhouse, the Illinois teenager charged with shooting 3 people and killing 2 of them during protests in Kenosha last year. The jury's tasked to determine whether he acted lawfully in self-defense. The judge in the case dismissed a misdemeanor charge against Rittenhouse earlier today. He will allow the jury to consider lesser charges in their verdicts on the remaining counts. We are recapping the prosecution and defense arguments and getting a better understanding of the jury's responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the different charges against Rittenhouse or what you've seen or heard about the trial as it's been going on? What do you think of the argument that he was or wasn't acting in self-defense? Do you think Wisconsin law needs to change in any way based on what you've heard about the case? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome to Central Time.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is a case, obviously, that's gotten attention around the state, around the country. In a courtroom, how insulated can people really be from that knowledge of the wider interest in that case?
Well, I don't think it would be possible to have been in Kenosha for the last year and not have heard something about the case, or really in all of Wisconsin, maybe even the country, because of the level of publicity that it's received. The challenge really for the jurors as they're being selected is to really ask themselves, despite what they may have heard about the case, Do they still have an open mind? Can they weigh the evidence that's presented during the trial and come to a verdict that has not been pre-decided?
You've looked, I know, at the jury selection process. How careful are both sides, prosecutor and defense, to try to make sure that they don't get someone who already has their mind made up on the opposite side?
The real focus for them is to we often say when picking a jury, it's not so much who you're picking to be on the jury. It's the folks that you're trying to remove from the jury. You're deselecting people to serve on the jury because you fear that they may be biased or prejudiced or they may have prejudged the case. And so those are the folks you're trying to kind of weed out. And then you're left with the folks that you hope do have an open mind and can listen to both sides and will judge the case based on the evidence that's presented in the courtroom and not what they've heard about the case through different media sources.
As you look at the different charges, a handful still remaining after the dismissal of that misdemeanor firearms charge, what kind of things are you looking at with what the jury has to decide on based on what both sides have shown them? What kind of standards are required for a guilty verdict on these charges?
Well, the jury always has to be satisfied with any of the charges that the prosecution has proven each element of the case beyond a reasonable doubt. From the defense perspective, I think the defense will be making a fairly straightforward argument to the jury that Mr. Rittenhouse was acting in self-defense, that he was acting reasonably in self-defense that evening. And if the jury believes that, or at the very least, if they do not think that the prosecution has been able to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was acting in self-defense, then he should be acquitted of the remaining charges. The prosecution has a couple of different theories behind how they've charged the case. In one instance, the first person who was shot that night, Mr. Rosenbaum, the prosecution has charged Mr. Rittenhouse with first-degree reckless homicide, which requires that they show utter disregard for human life, that Mr. Rittenhouse acted with utter disregard for human life. But with the other shooting that followed of Mr. Huber, they've charged first-degree intentional homicide so that they need to show that Mr. Rittenhouse indeed intended to kill and caused his death. And they've also charged attempted first-degree intentional homicide with regard to Mr. Grosskreutz. So again, they have to prove that Mr. Rittenhouse attempted to cause his death intentionally.
The judge has instructed the jury, or will be allowing the jury, I understand, to consider different types, possibly lesser charges than the ones the prosecution originally brought. Is that something we would usually see at this stage in a process?
Yes, you would. In fact, Wisconsin by law has lesser forms of homicide are included in more serious forms of homicide. And usually in a case like this, depending on what witnesses the jury might believe or what theory of the case is being argued to them by the defense or the prosecution, it's normal to sort of present to them a range of options, often lesser included offenses, so that they can decide what level of culpability or responsibility they should assign to the defendant's conduct, if they assign any culpability at all. So another sort of level of difficulty, admittedly, for the jury to sort through, but not unexpected.
Talking to John Gross from the UW Law School, director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the closing days of the Kyle Rittenhouse trials. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following the trial, what has struck you? What questions do you have about what you've seen and heard there? Do you have thoughts on the argument over self-defense and whether it should apply? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. John, a lot of attention to Judge Bruce Schroeder and his style of running a court, and apparently, according to a lot of court reporters and judges or lawyers who have argued in front of him, this is just his normal kind of court demeanor. Do you have thoughts on what he's done, some of the decisions he's made along the way?
Well, I too have heard the same thing, that this is his the normal way that he runs his courtroom. I would say that, you know, he does permit himself to give quite a bit of, I think, commentary along the way, which is something that is not always so desirable from the judge. He definitely has spent a lot of time engaging with the lawyers, talking about the jury instructions and other aspects of the case. And so I sort of wonder if some of these issues couldn't have been parsed out before the trial began, which would have eliminated the need to have quite so much back and forth between the parties and the judge over different evidentiary issues and different rulings regarding the dismissal of a charge and the eventual decision to how to charge the jury and what lesser included offenses to include. But yeah, this appears to be par for the course for him.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hello.
Hi there. I just wanted to call and comment on the DA Binger's closing arguments. He made a lot of statements that were either factually inaccurate or were in conflict with statements that he made earlier in his closing argument. For instance, he made a comment that there was no cars on the lot that night and that Kyle Rittenhouse could have run away. There was no reason for him to be there. He also made the comment that when he was running away down the street, that he could have fired warning shots even after he said that this rifle had, you know, severe or significant power and was very dangerous. He still made the comment he should have fired warning shots. And lastly, he made the comment that Gage Grosskreutz's arm was blown off when he was shot. And that, you can see in the video, is factually inaccurate. I think he couldn't keep his story straight, and I think it's something worth listening to.
Andrew, thanks for the call. John, did you see? Have you seen problems with the prosecutor's case not conforming to the facts, including the video evidence?
Well, whenever parties make closing arguments, they are free to urge to the jury whatever inferences, whatever conclusions they think was warranted by the evidence. The judge has instructed the jury previously that, you know, whatever the lawyers say in closing argument, it is just that. It's argument. And if the juror's recollection of the facts or the evidence is inconsistent with what the lawyer is presenting to them during closing argument, if they think the testimony was different, it's their recollection that controls in the case. And so, you know, also the defense is listening to that argument, and I'm sure if they felt that the prosecution was mischaracterizing evidence or misstating evidence, they could have objected to it. But generally speaking, you know, you have some leeway when you're giving your closing argument to pick and choose the facts that you want to emphasize to the jury. But again, you know, if the jury is listening to that argument and they believe that the lawyer is stretching the truth or misstating the facts or ignoring other relevant, important facts that were testified to, then that could diminish the strength of their closing argument.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the Kyle Rittenhouse trial coming to a close today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what you've seen and heard in the courtroom about what qualifies as self-defense in Wisconsin law? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with John Gross. He's director of the Public Defender Project and a clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School. We're talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and the decision that faces the jury in Kenosha County. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to some of the closing arguments on both sides, especially as it pertains to self-defense. First, here's Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger for the prosecution saying Rittenhouse can't claim self-defense because he argues he created the danger he faced.
When the defendant provokes the incident, he loses the right to self-defense. You cannot claim self-defense against a danger you create. That's critical right here. If you're the one who is threatening others, you lose the right to claim self-defense.
Now here's defense attorney Mark Richards responding to that argument in his closing arguments today.
He has as much right to go there as anybody else in the city of Kenosha and be unmolested by the likes of Joseph Rosenbaum, Kelly, and Joshua Zeminski.
So that argument about provoking the incident, negating the self-defense, how does a jury suss that out?
Yeah, so I think one of the challenges here for the jury and the difference in the narrative that both sides are presenting is that the prosecution is presenting this as if Mr. Rittenhouse's presence there with this AR-15 assault rifle when there was a curfew in place, when he was arguably not legally entitled to have the weapon, and by carrying it openly amongst people who were engaged in civil disobedience, protesting, that in itself was a type of provocation, that he basically created this dangerous situation and that therefore he would be deprived of his right to act in self-defense. The defense is claiming that he had as much right, as they said, as anybody else to be there, and that he was not the aggressor. In fact, Mr. Rosenbaum and some other of the people who were out protesting that evening were the ones who were acting aggressively and erratically toward him, that the entire environment was one where it was dangerous and there were people on both sides acting in ways that sort of caused a heightened level of tension. And so when Mr. Rittenhouse fired, he was doing so in self-defense. He was not the one who had initiated the confrontation between himself and Mr. Rosenbaum.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Yeah, I didn't follow the trial that much, but was he hired by somebody to come up and protect their property? Did he just show up with a high-powered rifle and take that upon himself? I mean, you would think the police wouldn't want people running around that aren't deputized.
Thanks a lot for the call. Yes, there was an online campaign to try to bring civilians in, they said, to defend property and people against protesters or rioters if that ensued. Does that matter for the case, the trial, that much, John, why Rittenhouse was there in the first place?
Well, I think the prosecution has certainly made some arguments or tried to cast him in the light as being somebody who was an outsider, right, who came to Kenosha and had no connection to Kenosha, there was no good reason for him to essentially be there. There was certainly no good reason for him to be there with a rifle. There was some testimony, too, I think, about officers, you know, at least handing out water and thanking some of the folks who were there with rifles who claimed to be defending property. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the jury is not really being asked to decide whether or not it was a good idea for him to be there or whether or not he somehow was given permission to be there by the police officers. They're really just focused on in his confrontations with those three people that he shot. Was it reasonable at that time for him to use deadly force in self-defense?
Thanks for the call, Jimmy. We'll go to Karen now in Madison. Karen, hello.
Oh, first of all, I have to say concealed carry, open carry, all of that just opened a violence mechanism in this state. And you can see that in the statistics of shootings and the numbers of people buying guns. But I also, and this doesn't have anything to do with the trial, but I know that if this young man had been a person of color and done the same thing, and he would not have been able to walk through all of those police officers and leave, he would have been killed. And I know that for a fact. And so we have a long way to go on what real justice is. And it's tragic that this young man did this. It's tragic that people encouraged him to by having hate. And it's tragic that the people died that they didn't need to die.
Karen, thanks a lot for the call. As Karen said, John, that probably won't be an issue or a direct factor in the trial. But do you have thoughts on some of those wider issues Karen raises there, and that certainly people are going to be thinking about when this trial ends, however it ends?
Yeah, I mean, there are several issues here that I think may resonate far beyond whatever the specific verdict is. I mean, one issue is, you know, Wisconsin has both open carry and concealed carry. You know, what is the wisdom of having or permitting open carry or concealed carry when you are at an event that is a protest, right? I mean, why permit both protesters or counter-protesters to go about armed and create a public safety concern in that instance? I mean, a lot of folks are also feel very strongly that, you know, that an acquittal of Mr. Rittenhouse will somehow just highlight racial bias in the system, that because he is a young white man, he is going to be permitted to use deadly force against other people in a way that would never, our system would not have permitted a person of color in the same situation to have behaved in the same way. And this again touches on issues about, you know, police use of force and the perception of our justice system as potentially racially biased. And so there are a lot of concerns with this case. I will say this. I mean, the verdict is not a referendum on any of those things. The verdict is not a referendum on the right to carry a gun. It's not a referendum on the right to protest. It really is. The jury's job is to stay focused on whether or not the prosecution has proven the specific charges against Mr. Rittenhouse beyond a reasonable doubt.
Karen, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller with Pat in Brookfield. Pat, hello.
Hello. Yeah, just a question for the professor. I found it somewhat interesting. It seemed like initially the prosecution was trying to prove that these individual interactions, so, you know, 1, 2, and 3, that Kyle Rittenhouse reasonably did not need to defend himself. It didn't reach that level, or he was the aggressor individually in these interactions. As the trial played on with the various testimony, even from the third victim, in addition to all of the video evidence, I'm wondering if they saw this as breaking their case, to where it seems now very recently, and in the closing arguments you heard today, they were talking a lot about provocation and the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse was just there with a gun that automatically eliminates any self-defense. And I'm wondering if that's their strategy now because they understand that they're going to have a really hard time, or they did have a hard time, or frankly, they weren't able to make the connection to that the fact that he wasn't using reasonable self-defense in these individual interactions.
I gotcha, Pat. We're running short on time, so I'm going to cut you off. But, John, I've heard other people make that case that the prosecution seemed to switch gears in that way.
Yes. I think the prosecution has a real challenge in front of them. I mean, when they called Mr. Grosskreutz, he admitted on cross-examination that Mr. Rittenhouse did not shoot him until he was pointing a gun at him. And that seems to really make the defense's argument for them. And so with the evidence showing what it has showed in this case, I think now the prosecution may have decided that they needed to, as you said, shift gears a little bit and argue more broadly that just Mr. Rittenhouse's presence there, his presence armed in the way that he was, is sufficient provocation that would deny him the right to claim self-defense.
Thanks for that call. And just our last half minute, John, I of course won't ask you to predict what a jury will do, but you can leave us with a half minute or so of thoughts on the options before them here.
Well, I will say this. I think, you know, They have some difficult decisions to make in this case. One of the things that they will have to decide is, even if Mr. Rittenhouse was even if he believed that subjectively that he was entitled to use self-defense, was it reasonable for him to think that? And if they find that, then it's possible that they could convict him of the second degree homicide charge. And frankly, I think that might be the prosecution's best hope for conviction, because there has been enough of a claim of self-defense in this case that I think, did he reasonably think he was entitled to use self-defense, or did he subjectively think so? Yes.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to John Gross from the UW Law School, looking at the Rittenhouse case, closing arguments happening today. What's the most expensive Apple product being sold this month? No, it's not an iPhone or an iPad or an iMac, though those can all be pretty expensive. No, the big money investment is an Apple One computer made in 1976. As reported by NPR, an Apple One computer sold for $400,000 at a California auction house. Apparently, it still works. It looks old with a small monitor and the wooden case. The computer originally sold for over $600 in 1976 to a professor who sold it to a student the next year, making way for an Apple II. The student held on to it until now, got a pretty good return on investment. Fun fact, when I first started screening calls here at WPR in 1999, our call screening computer was an Apple II Plus. Yes, it was incredibly obsolete by then. It did the job. Sometimes, though, it didn't start, and you had to give it a little Fonzie tap on the back to get it firing up. Might be worth something today. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.